Welcome to the second season of the Fireside Podcast, presented by the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. I'm Chase Maxwell. Years ago, the Friends began a storytelling series for adults. What could be better than sitting by the fire, sipping a warm cup of coffee or cider, while listening to some of the best writers Minnesota has to offer? Over the years, the Fireside series has featured a great range of authors, from Kate DiCamillo to Jack Weatherford, Carol Bly to Marlon James, making the winter just that much more bearable. The 2016 season continues this great legacy of presenting Minnesota's best authors reading by the fire. After a great response last year, we've decided to continue podcasting the series in its entirety. Beth Dooley joins the Fireside series to share her journey of coming to know and being an integral part of the Heartland food community. When Dooley moved to Minneapolis from her native New Jersey more than 30 years ago, she had a lot of preconceptions about the Midwestern food scene. But as she explored farmers markets and the burgeoning co-op scene in the Twin Cities, these assumptions faded, and she eventually discovered a local food movement strong enough to survive the toughest winter. Dooley has been involved with the local food movement for more than 20 years. She's the author of numerous award-winning cookbooks about Heartland food traditions, and her travel and food writing has been featured in the Star Tribune, Vine Cooking, Delta Sky Magazine, and the North American Review. She's also regularly a featured guest on NPR's Appetites with Tom Cran. And now, Beth Dooley.
Thank you. What a lovely introduction. Thank you very much. Oh, wow, thank you, and thanks so much for coming out tonight. I'm really glad it wasn't last night that I was supposed to speak. I have a confession to make about libraries. I love libraries, and when I was supposed to be researching things in high school or in junior high, I'd sneak off and read the cookbooks. And that's where I discovered, and I bet they have it, Lillian Hellman wrote a cookbook, which it was never publicized as Lillian Hellman's cookbook. She wrote it with a young man whose last name was Farber, and She wrote half of the book using his recipes, and he wrote the second half of the book using her recipes, and they told stories about each other. And my favorite story about Lillian Hellman is that she would invite all of her friends to come once a year to her home in Long Island, on Fire Island, where all the great literary lights hung out. So she'd send out these engraved invitations to Norman Mailer and all these famous people, and they'd respond, and every morning for the month before this event, she would wake up and she would write down what the menu was going to be. And then the next morning she'd wake up and she'd write down a different menu, and on and on and on. And then the morning of the event, she would rush down to the farmer's market, ignore the menu that she'd written out, ignore her shopping list, come back, clean like a banshee, cook like a mad woman, and then she'd kick back with a martini and a cigarette and say, "Who the hell invited all these goddamn people anyway?" So it's a charming book, and I see if you can find it here. I bet they have it. Well, in Winter's Kitchen, and I just want to take a minute and thank you all for coming out, but mostly for Meta Nielsen, who is this fabulous photographer, who is the photographer on several of my books, the most recent, Minnesota's Bounty, the Farmer's Market Cookbook. So, and she also contributes to the columns that we work on together for the Star Tribune, which we kind of call the gardener and the cook. Because Meta is an amazing gardener. So if you have any questions about gardening, don't ask me, ask Meta. She's amazing. So, a lot has changed since my husband and I moved here about 37, 38 years ago to a land my father called Mindianapolis. And my brother gifted us one of those great big posters showing New York City on one half of the country and Los Angeles on the other half of the country, and a thin ribbon of the Mississippi running in between, and nothing else. It was flyover land. It was land of the jolly ho-ho-ho green giant, and it was fields and fields of corn. And I really didn't know what to expect when I packed up excuse me, when I packed up our starter furniture, our wedding presents, as well as my grandmother's ward bread trencher and her deadened copper bowl, tools of my past that seemed essential to my future. As a child, I'd gone with that grandmother, Elizabeth Flower, to her home on the New Jersey shore, and as we drove Route 35, she'd break at each farm stand to chat with Dolores or with Bonnie. She'd thump melons, check the white princess corn, and she'd share recipes clipped from the Newark Star-Ledger. In her blue Cadillac, the seats sticky with heat, I'd bite into a sun-warmed peach so ripe that the juice dribbled down my arm. Everything my grandmother cooked, the blue crabs from Spike's Fish Market, the milk in glass bottles from Borden's Creamery, came from a person and a place that had a name. I'd help slice those Jersey tomatoes into fat wheels, tomatoes that reminded me of the taste of summer itself. Now, my first writing job was for the Princeton Packet, covering the beat nobody wanted because I was a cub reporter and I really didn't know how to say no. I was told to go out and cover those zoning and planning board meetings. But you know what? They were fascinating. They were contentious. There were lawyers that came in with their clipboards and great big charts, and then there were these farmers that were desperate to retire and didn't have anyone to take on the job of farming, and then there were residents that lived nearby that didn't want to see those farms gone. The bucolic landscape gave way to malls and condos for New York and Philadelphia commuters, and by the time we left for Minneapolis, the farm stands that I had toured with my grandmother along Route 35 were gone. To find a Jersey tomato, you had to grow it yourself. So landing here, I discovered the farmer's market, and it quickly became more than a source of the week's fresh produce. It was a wellspring of inspiration, a weekly calendar of the land's bounty and a source of new friends. Gorgeous carrots from a Vietnam vet, Jean Kroger, bok choy from the Vang family, corn from a Tina Diffley, who advised me to cook kale with a ton of sesame oil and a whole lot of garlic. And then she stopped and quipped, "Yeah, but you know, gravel tastes good that way too." She's great, and you know what? She's a really good friend. She wrote the book, Turn Here, Sweet Corn, which won the Minnesota Book Award for Best Memoir. It's fabulous, so if you haven't read it yet, read it. I'm sure they have it at the library, right? It's great. Every day, as I strolled the aisles of that farmer's market, I could almost feel my grandmother's hand in mine. Now, my mother had slipped a copy of Joy of Cooking into one of our moving boxes, and as I unpacked it, it greeted me like an old friend. This was a book I'd read as a teenager when I should have been studying, and later, whenever I felt lost or lonely or homesick, I turned to cookbooks to soothe and to entertain. Because, you know, beneath a cookbook's list of ingredients and steps to follow lie tales as rich and deep as any to be found in fiction. Cookbooks and recipes are forays into families' homes and glimpses into far-off lands, redolent of garlic and rosemary, of saffron and cardamom. Recipes are stories with happy endings, of being sated and cared for in a way that feels gentle. And I'll even suggest that the intentions of a cookbook author are the same as those of a novelist, to use both creativity and format to transmit an experience to the reader. The year we moved here, I'd offered to host our family's first Thanksgiving. Do you all remember the first time you hosted Thanksgiving? The first time it would not be in our family's sprawling home in suburban New Jersey. I was so innocent, and I was so ambitious and so excited to share my new discoveries with my family, and they all said yes, they'd come. But you know, Thanksgiving is kind of like taking that first ride on a one-wheel bicycle when you always had training wheels, right? It's exhilarating and it's really scary. Okay? And I had no idea what I was going to get into. That Thanksgiving Eve, the Twin Cities were hit with the season's first snowstorm. Wet, sloppy snow that snarled air traffic. So it was about midnight when everyone finally arrived. We all six of us squeezed into the Datsun and crept along as clumps of ice pummeled the car and glazed the windshield making it impossible to see as freight trucks barreled by. The giddiness of our reunion soon congealed into an uncomfortable silence. I missed her exit not once, not twice, but three times, driving up and around the freeway until, on the third try, as we passed the grain silos on Hiawatha Avenue, my father could hold back no longer and asked me in a whisper, thin with impatience, "Beth, do you know where you are?" That question rings through these pages. I sensed that to find my place here, I had to cook my way home. You know, that Thanksgiving morning, my mom asked, looking askance, "No creamed onions?" Even though no one but Aunt Ruth actually ate those bird's eye pearl onions in real cream sauce, but their absence seemed a slight against her memory. As unspoken resentments and sibling rivalries and secret rages fueled by the exhaustion of holiday travel threatened to boil over, I realized that there was really only one thing we could do, and that was to get everybody into the kitchen to cook. My brothers peeled apples for the pies, Harrelson apples so tart and hard and sweet. My dad glazed the turkey with whiskey and maple syrup, and my sister whipped the cream. Being in the kitchen knitted us together in ways we did not know we'd forgotten. Through these years, I found the clues to finding my place by strolling fields, making cheese, butchering chickens, and cooking in restaurant kitchens. What I found is that there is much more going on in the Northern Heartland, aka flyover country, than the rest of the country really knows. While the coasts, both the East and the West Coast, have been claiming the culinary conversation, our farmers, processors, our artisans are creating food with integrity and purpose. In fact, they've been doing it since this well before the term local food became a cliche. Each chapter in this book is focused on one food from this region that figures in all the American Thanksgiving meals. Apples, corn, potatoes, cranberries, sweet potatoes, chestnuts, milk, cheese, butter, wild rice, and turkey. And each chapter explores a particular issue related to local food: flavor, health, the environment, fair wages, animal welfare. There's some disturbing information for sure, but there's also a lot of positive news. As an example, what you'll find in these pages, I thought I'd share an excerpt from the first chapter, Apples. And I chose this section because the apple is a democratic fruit, as varied and interesting and diverse as the Northern Heartland itself. Apples. Each of us has at least one fairy tree in our life, whether or not we remember. Mine was the apple tree. The apple tree in my childhood backyard. Its U-shaped trunk was a wild place for me to hide with Daisy, our gangly yellow lab. When the blossoms burst open, we'd lounge in their fragrance, waiting for spirits to dust the flowers into ruby fruit. And later, I'd climb the branches to fill a pillowcase while Daisy licked the sticky juice from my hands. Such a tree greeted me some 35 years later in western Wisconsin at the farm campus of our son's Montessori school, Lake Country. This tree predates World War I and reveals the farm's history with a simplicity that would elude the most gifted storyteller. This sturdy, gnarled survivor is the first thing you see when you head up the dirt drive. Its low branches are open and welcoming, a ready embrace. It blossoms splendidly and produces lady apples with yellowish skins, pretty red cheeks, and a faint scent of strawberries and rose. It's a variety that grows especially well here, needing long cold winters to go dormant and snow to protect it from the harsh temperatures and then provide moisture come spring. When our young sons wriggled up into the branches for the ping pong sized fruit and then dropped with a small thud to chase each other across the field. Picking apples is a quiet and absorbing task. You're centered on a thin limb, stretching on tiptoe into the leaves. It seems the most prized apples are always the hardest to grasp. Cradled in the scent of ripe and rotting fruit, you gain perspective on the earth's daily spin from a sweet, safe perch. A good apple tastes of September sun, the warm waning light, of its lineage, of the weather, the soil, and the way it was tended. All this is to say that a good apple is the taste of balance, a range of natural acids and sugars with notes so complex and so different that they come on waves of flavor with each bite. When cooked, a good apple may lose some of its subtlety, that hint of raspberries, pepper, or sage, while the essential character of the sharp and the sweet becomes more intense. The variety of fruit and where it was grown informs its flavor, just as the experience of the eater has everything to do with how the taste is received. So I doubt that I would love apples so very much if I'd never climbed into those trees as a child. The old apple tree is a regal reminder of the variety and diversity of the upper Midwest's small, independent orchards and fertile backyards. Up until the 1960s, our region grew over 15,000 apple varieties. But today, only about 3,000 remain accessible to orchard keepers, gardeners, chefs, and home cooks. But that's changing thanks to the work of orchardists like Dan Bussey, the country's foremost pomologist, aka Apple Geek, and manager of Seed Savers Heritage Orchards in Decorah, Iowa. This James Audubon of apples is a vigorous man with piercing blue eyes, ruddy cheeks, and sinewy arms that resemble the limbs of the tree he so dearly loves. Over the past 10 years, he's been cataloging over 17,000 varieties for a 7-volume series, nearly 3,000 pages long, entitled The Illustrated History of Apples in North America. It describes all the different kinds of apples known to have grown between the years 1623 and 2000. The rolling historic orchard is a grand central station of trees. The tall and the straight rub shoulders with the gnarled, skinny, and squat, over 1,100 different varieties. It's one of the largest collections in the country. Bussey loves saying the names of these apples. Sheep's nose, Shishango strawberry, cow's snout. Every apple has a purpose for baking, for making into sauce, for turning into sweet or hard cider, and for eating out of hand. We need this diversity to have a secure orchard because different trees respond differently to the weather, pests, and disease, he told me. If one kind of tree is destroyed, others will survive. Diversity is the key to resilience and to flavor. Yet today, in this region, nearly 70% of our apples are shipped in from Oregon and Washington. Many are Honeycrisp, ironically, the apple created by the University of Minnesota, and now grown in huge volume along the West Coast. What do we forfeit when we rely on other regions to provide us with food we can grow ourselves? We gain reliability and consistent supply, of course, but we lose the flavor of a diverse life and its savor, the knowledge that this flavor is only a season long or only found with some searching. By growing a diverse food system in the heartland, orchardists like Bussey are helping to ensure that there is yet magic in the world to attract our children to the outdoors and the richness that can imbue their lives with the memories of a vibrant past. You know, that saying, the apple never falls far from the tree, is a catch-all for the strengths and weaknesses the older generation passes on to the young. Among farmers, the wisdom is a positive. Bussey and others are working to preserve heirloom apples, making it possible for others to learn old ways and carry them forward, melding modern technology and ecological wisdom. Our 19th century apple diversity reflected a variety of purposes and needs, and it reflected an appetite for differences. When we taste a good apple, we taste the biodiversity it represents. If we succumb to a world of the generic apple, we are in danger of becoming generic as well. Cultivating ourselves is the first step towards diversifying our orchard and our lives. Seed Savers, Hoke Orchards, Sweetland Orchard, and so many of our orchards are growing apples in wonderful shapes, colors, and flavors that can delight us all. Their enjoyment requires nothing more than our attention to the trees and their tails. This fruit has a special meaning among people who know what they're eating. In many ways, the apple may lead us to a greater understanding and appreciation of our food and our land in the same way the original apple in that Garden of Eden provided another kind of wisdom that may carry us forward. You know, it's only been in my short 60-year lifespan that gardening and cooking have become recreational. But local food is not a novelty. It's going to be very important when energy prices begin to soar once again and unstable weather is the norm. The better we know our food, the more likely we are to understand firsthand how our federal policies, like the Farm Bill, support commodity crops but hamper vegetable growers. why it's so important that dairy cows graze on grass, and why the work that's being done by farmers like Atina Diffley to help open pollinate corn is so vital. When we cut into a slice of bread made with Sunrise Milling flour, which is a heritage grain, we can taste the potential for our city to reclaim its position as milling capital of the world. The Northern Heartland is the center of the world's fertility, where industrial agriculture and global food companies are front and center in our economic, political, and physical lives. Yet there is a vibrant, powerful local food system that's moving the region toward food sovereignty. And if that can happen in a climate where the ground freezes hard for so much of the year, it can happen anywhere in the country. So thank you very much for listening to all this, and I hope you eat well.
We've reached one of the best parts of the Fireside series, the Q&A with the author and our dedicated audience at Hamlin Midway Library. It's a chance to go beyond the book, connecting readers and writers on a deeper level. To make it easier for you, the listener, I've summarized the questions and will read them. First up, an audience member asks about Dooley's writing habits. Does she have a set schedule or daily writing goal?
You know, that's a great question. I have a goal and I have a schedule, which I ignore every day. I'd like to say I'm that disciplined, but because I write for the newspaper as well, I'm also hooked to deadlines. So there are times that, because I'm on deadline, I will have to focus on one story for all day, you know, and chase someone around and go to a couple meetings and then write at night. And then there are other times, if I have the luxury of carving out time to not have to deal with, you know, a weekly deadline or a, you know, every other month deadline or something like that, I will intentionally schedule in, say, a 3-hour block, which is about as long as I can sit. I tend to be a little ADD, which is why I really love working on cookbooks, because I can write and then hop up and test something. I also have a writing group that I write with once a week, and so we commit to sitting down and writing together. We don't read to each other. The whole idea is that they show up at 9 o'clock in the morning, and we write from 9 until noon without talking. I put a pot of coffee on and we just sit and write. And so that helps as well. It's sort of like parallel play when your kids were little. So I write every day. How long depends on what else needs to happen that day in terms of meetings or appointments or interviews and things like that. But I mean, to answer your question, I do write every day, and it varies between 1 hour to 3 hours, and then sometimes if I'm on deadline, I'll write again at night if something's due. So, yeah, thanks.
Next up, Dooley is asked about her collaboration with local chef and restaurateur Lucia Watson, owner of Lucia's Wine Bar in Uptown Minneapolis. Can Dooley discuss that collaboration and other collaborations she's worked on?
Yeah, it's really fun. I love collaborating, especially on cookbooks. In fact, I'm working right now on a cookbook with Netta Nielsen on a preserving book. She's very good at preserving and has a lot of great ideas. And then I'm also currently working on a book with a young American Indian who goes by the name, his company is called The Sous Chef. And he's the brains behind the Tatanka truck. And so it's pre-colonial American Indian food. Lucia and I got to be, and actually the story of writing the book with her is in Winter's Kitchen. We became really good friends first before we decided to work together, collaborate together on Savoring the Seasons. I had been working for an advertising company, and then I'd gone back into teaching, and then I'd written a couple of much smaller books for Story Communications. And I met Lucia through a friend, and we actually became friends through our dogs. We both had big Labradors at the time, and we'd go out for these long walks, and we'd talk about food, and her restaurant was going really well. And I finally approached her and said, hey, would you ever want to do a cookbook? And she said, yes, but I'm super busy right now, and I don't particularly love to write, so that's how we collaborated. And on that project, it was intentionally guided by our author, Judith Jones, who had discovered Julia Child and had in mind book Savoring the Seasons for her series, Knopf Cooks American. There are 8 books in that series, and each of them focuses on a different aspect of American cuisine that she felt was in danger of being lost. And because Judith and her husband, Evan, who was also a cookbook writer, had lived in Minnesota for about 2 years because his family at that time owned the paper in Northfield, and they came back to help resuscitate that paper. She was very familiar with this area, and she felt that it was really underrepresented, and she felt that people misconstrued the Midwest as being one big area. And she said, you know, there's really a northern tier, and then there's a southern tier, that, you know, the Great Lakes, Superior region, and Kansas City are nothing alike. And so she kind of guided that work. And then as Lucia and I worked together, I did a lot of the research, most of the historical research, and did a lot of the interviewing of elders and people that had recipes like petitza and things like that, that wanted to share those recipes. And Lucia's brilliance, of course, is as an amazing chef who has a really good sensibility around flavors and how to bring them to light. And so we did a lot of testing in her restaurant. She also had a number of family recipes that we drew off of. And because she's so embedded in this region's culture, she had always been sort of a nose to tail kind of a cook. I mean, she knew how to butcher hogs, she knew how to clean the venison she thought, you know, shot, you know, or clean fish and dress venison. So she really knew what this region was about and guided, you know, what really belonged in the book and what didn't. And that's how we worked together. It was really fun. It was great. And, you know, and that's pretty much how I work with when I collaborate with other chefs, is bringing what they're doing to the page as a home cook. Because it's really important that, you know, that works in a restaurant kitchen work at home, and it often doesn't. I think that's one of the struggles of working with a restaurant chef, is trying to bring that into the kitchen. Because no one has, you know, 3 tons of veal stock bubbling on the back of the stove, right? So how do you replicate those flavors at home? So that's how we work together. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. Sorry, it's probably a longer answer than you wanted. Yeah, yeah. No, and Lucia was really, I mean, she's brilliant. She was really the first chef to recognize the importance of sourcing local food. I mean, she, you know, as a chef, she was most interested in flavor, and so she sought local food because it tasted the best. And then as a businesswoman, she understood the importance of connecting with other small businesses because they all shared the same values. You know, and they all sort of supported each other.
Following that, an audience member comments on the strength and diversity of local farmers markets and asks Julie to describe how these markets have evolved over the years.
That's a great question. You know, I was lucky because when we landed here, the Hmong community was going strong, yeah. Right? And they resettled here in the 70s. And they brought with them, like so many immigrants, seeds of their homelands, you know, in their pockets, and they planted them here, and they grew more than they could possibly eat and started bringing that to market. And that really changed our food scene, but it also changed the markets because they're such good growers. And it's interesting, our markets have a really long, different history. The St. Paul Farmers Market, the charter of the St. Paul Farmers Market was written into the founding papers, the fathers, you know, the St. Paul City fathers wrote it into the city's charter, which was so visionary, right? And it's always been a retail market. It's always been a market where the St. Paul citizens could shop as well as wholesale buyers, where the Minneapolis market got its start as a wholesale market. For years, that was only open to grocers and restaurants, okay? And that's why there's so many resellers there. Okay, so the two markets have very different histories and very different kind of cultures. But to answer your question, the markets have evolved greatly, as I think we eaters have evolved as well. I mean, the interest in local food drives demand, you know, encourages more farmers to present at market. The other thing I think is interesting is that those markets have also greatly influenced the restaurant scene and vice versa. So it all sort of works together. You know, it's all very holistic and in a pretty exciting way. It's been great for people like us that like to cook, right? And the other thing that I think is interesting is both the markets and the CSAs have changed how people think about food. Because if you're a farmer's market shopper, you go with an idea of finding out what's there before you decide what to cook, right? And so I think it's made us all a little more responsive as cooks, a little more nimble, a little more flexible, maybe a little more spontaneous, and less kind of, well, I'm going to make this out of Gourmet Magazine or Bon Appetit, and march into the store and buy all kinds of things. You sort of go and see what's there, load your basket up, and come home and then cook. So I think it's changed the way people think about seasonal food.
Next up, an audience member asked about the recipes in Dooley's cookbooks. Who does she usually recruit to test those recipes?
I have lots of neighbors and friends, and when my boys were around, they tested recipes. I always test them at least two or three times, and then I kind of let them go. But I also write them to be broad enough that people can adapt them, you know, based on what they have. You know, they're written to be flexible. The other thing that's really tricky, because I write a lot about cooking vegetables and, you know, cooking from scratch, is that I can't tell you whether or not your oven is calibrated. I can't tell you how ripe that tomato you bought at the farmer's market is when you brought it home. There's so many variables, you know, within a recipe that I hope in my instructions that I'm being clear about what to look for as the soup evolves, for instance, or as you're making a salad. This is what it should look like, this is what it should sort of taste like, or this is how the bread should sound when you bring it out of the oven. You know, you tap it, it sounds hollow. And that's how cookbooks used to be written back in the 1800s. Sarah Roper Joyner, who was one of the first cookbook writers here, you know, you go back and read her cookbooks, and there's a great collection at the Minnesota History Center, will tell you, you know, use butter the size of a nutmeg, use a coffee cup of flour, a teacup of sugar. The oven is ready if you can hold your hand in it and count to 10. If you can hold your hand in the oven and count to 15, it's not hot enough. I mean, things like that. So very descriptive writing, and that's what I try and bring to the page, because again, there's so many variables, and the idea of a good cookbook is to empower the cook to create something, not the Betty Crocker, as much as I love her, you know, stand on your right foot and stir with your left hand. It's got to leave a little something to cook's imagination. Yeah, it should be a conversation, really.
Following that question, Dooley discusses her opinions of the arguably infamous Honeycrisp apple invented at the University of Minnesota.
Without saying read the book, there's a long diatribe about Honeycrisp. Well, my favorite apple is the chestnut crab, which is a hybrid. It's a tiny apple. It's a cross between the you know, very tart sour crab and a Regent. And then there's the lady apple. Those are lovely. They're tart and crisp. There's keepsake, which is a very hard apple. It's a late season apple. It's hard and kind of dry, very tart. Wonderful to cook, but it really tastes like an apple. And I love Harlson apples. I think they're fabulous. They're really fabulous. Yeah, I think they are the best. In terms of the Honeycrisp, the story of the Honeycrisp is that Buford, who was the University of Minnesota researcher, loved apples. I mean, he had been an apple researcher, a pomologist for years before he came to the University of Minnesota. And at that time, the apple industry was in big trouble because of the Red Delicious apple, which, you know, had been flooding the markets for years, and they were never grown very well, they were never handled very well, and so that was the apple everybody thought of when they thought of apples, really thick skin, kind of mealy inside, not much flavor. And so he wanted to help revitalize the apple industry, which is what he did. I mean, it is a hybrid apple, it's not a GMO apple. And he created an apple, and it's hard to really explain, but what he did was create an apple that has larger cells than most apples, so it has more water in it, and it's a little sweeter. Now, the complaint, and I tend to agree with this, is that it's kind of a one-note apple, that it has a very singular flavor to it, they also tend to grow really big, and so by the time you've had three or four bites, because they're sweet and they're very juicy, you sort of feel as though you've had enough. They don't cook very well because they tend to collapse because they have so much water. And they don't keep very well because, again, they're so full of water. So you need to get them really fresh, and you need to eat them right away. Now, one of the problems with them is that they took off like mad when they were first grown. And the University of Minnesota released them to a lot of the Washington growers. And so the Washington growers kind of flooded the market. And the university had trademarked those apples, and so they were getting a cut off all of the trees they sold. They claim that they needed to do that because they say that apples are like any other product, that, you know, as a university product, we need to capture income from the research that we've done in order to do more research the same as we would if we were creating a medical device. And because the growers, especially the grower at Pepin Heights, was really concerned about so many growers on the West Coast growing Honeycrisp, they created an apple club, which they got into negotiations with the University of Minnesota, where they restrict the growers who are allowed to grow and sell those apples to volume, okay? And you have to apply, as a grower, you have to apply to be able to be in the club, and you have to grow at a particular scale. Now, Pepin Heights claims that that allows them control over the quality of the apple, and the local growers claim that that shuts them out of the market because they can't grow that many apples. So it's been very controversial. And another consortium of local growers brought suit against the Apple Club. It was called the Next Big Thing, and lost that suit, and then created their own group that is devoted to researching apples that grow particularly well in this terroir. One of the issues with the Washington apple is Washington Honeycrisp is it doesn't taste like the Honeycrisp that are grown here. And one of the other issues is that the Washington apples get shipped in here. They're often labeled local because they were created by the University of Minnesota, when in fact, yeah, they were created by the university, but they're really not a local apple because they're grown in Washington. So there's been a lot of brouhaha around it. But the other thing is that the Honeycrisp apple, and I can't remember the name of the organization that gave it an award, but it was awarded one of the great inventions of the world, right up there with the internet. I mean, it's seriously, if you go on, and I can't remember the name, but it's you know, best scientific, I can't remember, discoveries of the world or something. It's won all kinds of awards, so it's interesting. Yeah.
Does Dooley have a favorite farmer's market, either locally or outside of Minnesota?
My favorite farmer's market is wherever I am. I love the farmer's markets in Bayfield, Wisconsin. I love the Ashland Farmer's Market. I love the Duluth Farmer's Market. I love the St. Paul Farmer's Market. I actually am very fond of the Minneapolis Farmer's Market, even though it gets bashed all the time, and even though it's kind of a madhouse, and it's horribly organized. It makes the really good growers there crazy because nobody can find them, you know, and it's crowded, and the parking is hard, and blah, blah, blah. But it is a big city market. I love the diversity. I love the, you know, the jostling and the chaos and the smells and everything else. I mean, I just love farmers markets. I don't care where they are. I mean, I really, it's like saying, you know, who's your favorite child? I really can't tell you. I like them all. I really like them all. I think they're all really good. Yeah. I think what I really like about farmers markets is being able to talk to farmers. And, you know, the complaint against the Minneapolis farmers market is there are too many people selling that aren't farmers there, and I think that's true. But so I just go and find the farmers. You know, I just go and talk to the farmers. And they're pretty easy to find. Yeah, and you know, okay, my argument, you know, and I agree with that. I mean, I get that. But I think the thing I really love about the Minneapolis market is that it's provided access for people that can't afford fresh food in the grocery store. And it for many of them, it's closer than any of their supermarkets. And so if they want to buy, you know, bananas that are, you know, even cheaper than what you can find in Cub, that's great. I just think they need to be reorganized so that those resellers are in one area. And instead of calling them resellers, call them global market or something. You know, I mean, it doesn't need to be disparaged because in a way that can be lifted up. That's a really good thing. You know, and that's what I was trying to do with this book is kind of say, you know, this isn't an elite thing. This really isn't. And that's one of the arguments around local food is that, you know, people keep saying, well, it's only for yuppies or it's only for people that live in, you know, whatever area, be it Kenwood or, you know, Highland Park, or, you know, it's only for people that can afford this kind of food, when in fact, it's for people who like to cook. And if you, and I've done articles for Minneapolis St. Paul magazine and for The Strip where I've actually priced out the difference between, you know, fresh food and food at McDonald's or food that's prepared at the supermarket. And if you're cooking from scratch and you're being smart about it, they're really quite the same. And what you save, I mean, what you're getting in terms of health and just in the simple joy of cooking really makes up for what, you know, the few cents you're going to spend on that fresh product. And, you know, the other, I think, again, what I was trying to bring forward in this book is when we really begin to connect with our food, then we begin to care about the policies that are shaping how food is grown. And to me, that's probably the most important thing, especially in this election cycle, is we still, and I still don't understand the Farm Bill, and I've read everything I can possibly get my hands on. It shouldn't be that hard. And yet, it doesn't take much to understand that the federal policies that are underwriting commodity corn and commodity soybeans really are working against us. They're working against our farmers, they're working against our health, and we're paying for it in the long run because we're paying what it costs to clean up the hog farms, the manure that goes in and fouls our water. We're paying for the plastic that gets, you know, recycled. We're paying for the health outcomes of people that are made sick by eating bad food. And typically, they tend to be people who are impoverished and don't have many choices. And if we change the playing field, we will see parity between local food and commodity price-supported food. And that's one thing that I'm really disappointed none of the politicians have begun to talk about. And I'm hoping that that will finally be raised in this election cycle. Because, you know, we can make a difference, you know, but we do need to start questioning this sort of corporate welfare. So, this is not supposed to be a political thing, so, sorry.
Next up, an audience member asked Dooley if she's noticed greater interest in home cooking recently and greater consciousness for using local ingredients when home cooking, particularly among younger people.
I know. Yeah, no, just know how to turn the stove on. Yeah, I know. No, I know because I cater and I go into some of these kitchens and I'm just blown away by, you know, by how people don't. I don't know how to work their stoves and neither do they. It's pretty amazing. But yeah, there is. That's, you know, I have to say that, and again, this doesn't get talked about a lot, but I'm really heartened by a lot of the after-school programs, like Youth Farm is phenomenal. Appetite for Change is phenomenal, Design Center is phenomenal, and these are all after-school and summer programs that are focused on growing food, and then the kids that are in those programs harvest the food and take it in for lunch. And they have a cadre of chefs that volunteer their time, and they also have paid staff that are teaching these kids how to make their own food. The kids cook for each other, and it's terrific. And what's really great about those programs is that the ones that I participated in, the kid that, you know, there could be 20 or 30 kids in any program. There's a, you know, rotates kitchen crews every day, and those kids of the kitchen crew, they come in, they make the meal, the whole crew comes in, they sit down at the table, they talk to each other, they eat off plates, they use real forks and real knives. And for some of those kids, it's the only time they sit down to eat with somebody else the entire day, but it's really foundational for them. And those kinds of programs are really changing kids' lives. And I think, and there are more and more of them all the time.
Are people working to get their parents?
What's really nice is that the parents are involved, and a lot of those parents are first or second generation immigrant, you know, Latino, so they know how to make kick-ass salsas and really great stuff. And that's been great too, because it's an area where more and more parents can get involved. There's certainly a huge need for it, but there are now models that are working, which to me is really hopeful. They just, you know, again, they need more funding, they need more volunteers, you know, but they're really terrific programs, and there are a lot of really good ones here. I think there's more awareness for the need of that. Also, both the St. Paul and the Minneapolis public school systems are really working hard to change the food in the schools, and they're doing a good job.
Finally, can Dooley explain the difference between genetically modified organisms, GMOs, and the process of hybridization?
Yeah, GMO is a process in which a gene that belongs often to a different organism is inserted into an organism. I mean, that's not very scientific, but it's to try and create particular characteristics. And hybridization is allowing plants to cross-pollinate, basically, so that they might do that in the wild, but it's controlling that pollinization. And so it's like organisms that are mating, I guess, mating with each other, right, to create another organism. There's been a lot of controversy around GMOs and their impact on human health, My concern around GMOs is more around the amount of chemicals used to grow those plants, particularly corn and soy. And the companies that are creating these plants will tell you that they're doing it so they're reducing the amount of toxins used to grow them, but in fact, they're using stronger toxins. So it really isn't what it appears to be. And the other problem with GMOs is because they're not an adaptive plant, they're not created naturally, they don't change according to their surroundings. And so with corn, for instance, there's been tremendous flooding down in southern Minnesota, and the corn has been bred to survive drought, but it doesn't survive flooding very well. And so they've had a terrible time with, you know, these corn plants toppling over and rusting out and getting funguses and things like that. So they've really created more problems than they anticipated by having a plant that only does one thing, that's only good at one thing. The other thing is because the insecticide is inserted into the corn plant, you know, into the corn seed, one of the other problems is that that's controlled by the Department of Agriculture, not the FDA. So the FDA doesn't have jurisdiction over it, which is what this, you know, brouhaha around labeling is all about, because, you know, the Department of Agriculture is saying, well, it's not a food. You know, we're inserting a pesticide. That's under our bailiwick. And the FDA is saying, gee, we can't do anything about it because that's where, in fact, it's actually an ingredient in food. So that's, you know, that's one of the other issues too. That's anyway, write to Amy Klobuchar. Yeah.
I think we're winding down.
Thanks so much, everybody, for coming out. Thank you very, very, very much.
You've been listening to the second season of the Fireside Podcast, presented by the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. Next week, Erica Lee discusses her new book, The Making of Asian America, and the little-known history of Asian Americans and their role in American life, from the arrival of the first Asians in the Americas to the present day. Until then, we hope you consider supporting the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library and its mission, Stronger Libraries for Stronger Communities. Learn more at thefriends.org. Follow us on Twitter at The Friends and on Facebook at facebook.com/friendsofsppl. Please consider subscribing to this podcast on iTunes. Thank you for listening.